Good afternoon. Today, at the Indiana University School of Law, your moot courtroom has been transformed into a federal courthouse. We are grateful to Dean Rovell and staff of the law school for your thoughtful and careful planning in making arrangements for our visit. We also express our appreciation to the Indiana Court of Appeals for making the arrangements for the invitation to hold this outreach program in Indiana. We welcome students, faculty, members of our men and women of the armed forces, and public duty proceedings. We shall now proceed to the oral argument in the United States against that. We shall hear first from counsel to the appellant. Please proceed.
Now, please. My name is Lieutenant Kathleen Cadlick, and along with Lieutenant Brian Leiter, I represent the appellant in this case. Today we are here to assess whether or not Crawford v. Washington's legal reasoning has so undermined Maryland v. Craig that it is no longer good law. As applied to the case before us, the direct question is whether the Sixth Amendment right was violated when the accuser was allowed to testify via one lone video teleconference. Appellant asserts that in fact it was, and this error is not harmless.
Can I ask a question right off the bat? Are you arguing your case entirely on Crawford?
Crawford and its
If we were to take Crawford off the table and stipulate, or let's just stipulate Crawford never occurred, would you be here arguing that your case is distinguishable on the facts from Craig? Or are you accepting that if Craig is controlling, you lose?
Your Honor, we are accepting that Craig is controlling the decision.
Okay, thank you.
So you conceded any issue with respect to Rule 914 and whether the use of a closed circuit one-way television monitor in this case, as opposed to a two-way circuit, is irrelevant for purposes of this appeal?
What do you make of the sentence that says, however, such testimony should normally be taken by a two-way closed-circuit television system?
In MRE 914?
Correct.
Appellants?
You're welcome to concede that issue, but my job is to test.
Appellant's assertion is that neither one of them suffice to the textual interpretation of the right to confront.
Returning to Crawford.
So that if the court were to hold that Crawford did not overturn Craig, or at least were not in a position to overturn Craig, we would be concerned about compliance with Rule 914, that would have no concern for you or your client?
It wouldn't be applicable to the case of Margaron because the judge's findings down below apply now and because
but what about the language that says normally? Where did that come from and why is it there?
Appellant is not prepared to answer exactly where that came from, Your Honor, but in fact, in Craig, it was a one-way situation in that case as well.
But in theory, the rules could provide greater protections than the Supreme Court has provided through constitutional interpretation. Could they not?
In theory, they could not.
But you're persuaded they are co-permanents here.
Appellant respectfully requests to address that question.
Fair enough.
And when you do that, you might advise us as to what would happen if the Federal District Court, under Section 3509, this case has been tried there, and what implications under Article 36 of the UCMJ we would take from the manner in which the case has been tried in the Federal District Court.
Yes. Turning back to the Crawford application, almost 20 years ago, the Supreme Court noted in Boise, Iowa, that face-to-face presence may, unfortunately, upset the truthful rape victim or abused child. But by the same token, it may confound an unduly false accuser or reveal the child coached by a malevolent adult. Is it a truism that constitutional protections have caused?
Counsel, would you speak up?
Yes, Your Almost 20 years later, the court again visited the right to confront one of the accusers in Crawford, Washington. This represents a fundamental shift, engaging the requirements for testimony in and out of court.
Well, counsel, in between Floyd and Crawford, Maryland versus Federalist is like, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, Your
Honor. And isn't much of what you argue in your brief contained within Justice Scalia's dissent in that case?
It is, Your Honor.
And while it may well be the case that if Maryland versus Craig was decided again today, it would come out differently, can we ignore Supreme Court precedent based on the supposition that it would come out differently because the composition of the court has changed?
No, Jeff, you cannot. The position is that there's enough of an indication of Crawford as to the applicability and the undermining of Maryland and Crawford that there's no longer a team like that.
Well, where in the Crawford case is Maryland versus Craig mentioned?
It is not addressed.
And where in Maryland versus Craig does the court talk about the scope of the right to confrontation?
I'll address Maryland and Craig first. That's all
right. Well, no, I'm asking you specifically. You're saying that Crawford undermines Maryland versus Craig, and I'm asking you where in Crawford is the issue with respect to confrontation as opposed to the issue with cross-examination and unavailability? Where is the confrontation we should discuss in Crawford?
In Crawford. Can you repeat that question over?
Sure. I think what you're arguing is that Crawford undermines Maryland versus Craig, right?
Yes.
And I asked you where in Crawford Maryland versus Craig is discussed, and you acknowledge that it was not discussed, but it was nonetheless on point. And I'm asking you why.
Okay. Thank you. Maryland v. Craig rested on whether or not testimony was reliable and that there was a public policy exception to the explicit right in the Constitution to confront that. Now, going back to Crawford, the court acknowledged, they started out in their assessment in noting that they once again rejected the view that the Confrontation Clause applies its own force to only in-court testimony. So, it was clear that it applies to both in-court testimony and out-of-court testimony. Crawford v. Washington then dealt with out-of-court testimony in that case, but by no means is it limited to out-of-court testimonial statements. To assert that a different standard applies to testimonial out-of-court statements as to testimonial in-court statements is an untenable position. It's just not
logical. Why is it untenable?
It's just not logical, Chief Judge. I'm sorry, Judge
Stephanie. Yes.
It's time the air conditioning breaks. It's all right.
Crawford's a testimonial hearsay case.
It is.
Yeah. This is not. Neither is Craig. How do you fit them together?
Well, what's happened over time at the Supreme Court, in Craig, the standard that was actually applied to Craig, as Justice Scalia noted in his dissent, was one that the court had applied to the implicit rights of the Sixth Amendment. It used to be the explicit rights. And so, while the lines have been blurred in that respect, it's clear from the text of Crawford v. Washington, the interpretation that the Sixth Amendment does not suggest any open-ended exceptions from the confrontation requirement to be developed by the courts. Rather, the right to confront with the witnesses against them is most naturally read as a reference to the right of confrontation at common law, and meaning only those exceptions established at the time.
Aren't you arguing essentially not that Crawford is controlling, but having the benefit of Crawford, you are looking afresh at the plain text of the Confrontation Clause, and you are reading the word confrontation with new eyes? That's a question. Is this a case about Crawford, or is this a case about how to interpret the word confrontation in the Confrontation Clause?
It's how to interpret Crawford. If you look...
How to interpret Crawford? Are we dealing with out-of-court testimony here?
We are not, Your Honor.
Shouldn't you be arguing this with the confrontation clause? What it means to confront?
What it means to confront has been acknowledged throughout this. It's far back to Court of Iowa. The meaning of the right to confront, it's consistent in all of those opinions that
and
it's
what does it mean?
Face-to-face confrontation.
Now, is that what the opinion in Crawford said, or does the opinion say possibly in the meeting?
It talked about the right to confront.
Right, to confront and put it in the construct of cross-examination. Is it your position that you cannot cross-examine someone via a one-way or a two-way circuit system? Is that what you're ultimately arguing? You may question them, but it does not constitute cross-examination.
It violates one's right to confront, so that's a distinction.
Well, what if that's equivalent to confrontation?
It is not equivalent to.
And why isn't it equivalent?
Because that's an implicit right in the Sixth Amendment. And it's clear from
the Sixth Amendment refer to face-to-face?
It does not. It talks about the right to confront. But what's been read into that and never debated as far as the court is concerned.
There's at least 37 states and maybe 50 states now that think point. They operate on the assumption that you can confront someone by a circuit television. Why is that not confrontation?
Because the court is clear that it's the explicit right to confront in its face.
Counsel, you're saying that the court has acknowledged that, and I don't mean to belabor the point, but when you say the court, Coy might have suggested that, and Justice Scalia's dissent in the Maryland case certainly says that. And that might have been, in some people's minds, the best way to interpret the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment. But if it is, it's not the law. I mean, that wasn't the majority holding in that case. They went the other way. They said that the Confrontation Clause, the right to confront directly, was not absolute. And it gave way in light of the policy reasons that they decided to bump it. Isn't that what Maryland versus Craig did?
Your Honor, Maryland versus Craig, the court acknowledged that the meaning of confront did mean face to face, but that could be subject to policy considerations.
And wouldn't it be anomalous, after Crawford, you would read that? If the witness in this case had given deposition testimony, for example, unheard, and then become unavailable, that testimony would have been admissible under Crawford, right? Wasn't it anomalous to say that, well, that would be admissible if somehow it was a greater violation of the Sixth Amendment to have the person actually testify subject to cross-examination where the jury can see the witness?
The jury can see the witness, but the precedent point is that the accused and the accused can have the
So the Sixth Amendment compels a physical conflict.
Yes.
And has been held to do so consistently.
It has not.
Let me go off on another tack. If we accept your argument, are Rule 914A and 611 unconstitutional as applied?
If you accept Thomas Hunt.
Yes. Are they?
Yes.
They are. What then, as Judge Baker pointed out, you've got at least 3/4 of the states holding the contrary. If we accept your argument as a matter of federal constitutional law, then what, as a matter of public policy, do you suggest the states, and for that matter, the drafters of the rules, do in situations like this? We are then constitutionally compelled to bring the child and the accused face to face. Unfortunately.
Well,
so it's an unfortunate consequence of the Constitution.
It's
an unfortunate public policy consequence of the framers' choice. Okay. Fair enough.
Is there a military reason why there might be a different application of the Constitution and the Confrontation Clause in this context than in civilian practice?
No, sir.
Not a trick question. If Craig were controlling, for example, are you arguing that we should nonetheless interpret it in a manner because of particular aspects of military life?
That should not.
Counsel, to see if I can summarize your argument, let me know if this is what you're arguing, is that as a matter of constitutional law, the confrontation clause has two components. One is face-to-face confrontation, and the second is cross-examination. And that in Crawford, the Supreme Court addressed one aspect of it, cross-examination. And it determined that the prior ruling of Roberts could no longer be sustained because Roberts was based on a policy balancing argument. And that your argument here is that the same logic would apply with respect to the other leg of the confrontation clause, that is face-to-face confrontation, because Craig also relied on a policy balancing argument. Is that what you're asking us to consider today?
Craig, not only in part, that's correct. In part, it's because of the public policy aspect of Maryland and Craig. But also what cannot be overlooked is the reliability aspect of Maryland and Craig. Of course, focus on reliability, which, as far as testimonial statements, has been undermined, overruled by Crawford.
Very good. So, Craig is a 1990 decision, fairly recent as far as Supreme Court goes. Can you point to any situation in which the highest court of the state or the highest court in the federal circuit has overruled, in effect, a Supreme Court precedent that's less than 20 years old?
Okay.
So where would we get the authority to do that? Can you think of any of our cases, Albury, Sills, where we've said, hey, courts of criminal appeals, if you don't like what we're doing, just go in another direction?
No, Your Honor. The authority.
So where do we get the authority to say that Craig not only should be overruled, that is something that we could certainly suggest to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said that that's appropriate for us to give a suggestion. So where would we get the authority to actually disregard Craig and the precedent of our Superior Court?
The Supreme Court has acknowledged that the doctrine of implicit overruling, when they have articulated a different interpretation of the Constitution in a later case, that has fundamentally undermined a previous interpretation.
Has the Supreme Court ever said that a subordinate court can apply that doctrine?
Counsel, should we reject your constitutional argument? Is it all or nothing? Do you concede that if we reject your constitutional position, the military judge made adequate findings to support what was done in this case?
Pursuant to Maryland v. Craig.
Yes.
Not the military.
Well, counsel is going to address that under rebuttal. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Thanks. This error of constitutional magnitude was not harmless beyond the reasonable doubt in the defendant's case. According to this court standard, the United States begins, focuses on whether the error had reasonably may have an effect on the defendant's finding. In this case, there is no doubt that testimonial of the victim has substantial effect on the findings in this case. In fact, without it, there probably would not have been a conviction. Appellant brought forth five character witnesses at trial, one for his peacefulness and four for his good or outstanding military character.
Is there something about the cross-examination, or perhaps you would call it something else, that the it's determined in the record of trial, the cross-examination of the victim, that leads to your conclusion that any error was not harmless, or are you just basing this on other factors?
Well, in the United States, when the court did find a constitutional error in the case, what it did was took into account, ordered the lower courts to take into account everything except for the
I understand that, and what I'm asking is, when you review this record for in cross-examination, is there something in this that jumps out and you are saying, see, this is what's been affected? Or are you...
Don't they all have the right to face the cross-examination?
Didn't Corey suggest that if there was constitutional error of this type, that you'd have to assume that the entire testimony was committed because you could not validly assess what impact the presence of the confrontation would have had on the testimony?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you just have to assume that it's zero?
Yes.
And you understand what I was getting at? It was not whether, I understand the structural argument, but whether you were also drawing up particular examples in cross-examination where the person in the presence of the appellant, the answer itself might have been different.
Not drawing any specific.
How would you characterize the cross-examination?
Better violating
the right. No, I mean, do you think it was an effective cross-examination?
Appellant's
not prepared to talk. We'll have an opportunity on the
line. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from Mikas arguing on behalf of in support of the position taken by appellant.
May it please the court. I'm Captain Susan Texterina, and I am a speaker on behalf of Indiana University School of Law of Bloomington, law students and faculty. My interest in this case is that of a service member ensuring all other service members receive the full constitutional protections afforded them during court-martial proceedings. When the Supreme Court decided Crawford versus Washington, they once again made the Confrontation Clause a living issue. They strengthened what we feel to be confrontation and returned it back to its original meaning. It was the same meaning that the framers intended from the very beginning.
Can I jump ahead? In your brief, you also argued that service members are not only entitled to the full constitutional rights, but also the full benefit of the military rules of evidence. And do you care to address the 914 issue? Or Mike, could you please?
Your Honor, I would see that the closed circuit television that was broadcast was incorrect under the military rules for court-martial and military rules of evidence, simply because it also calls for the judge's presence to be moved into the room with the child testifying or with the remote testimony. The purpose of that is to bring the dignity and solemnity of the proceedings to that child and impress upon them what's going on. That did not occur in this case. So the military judge violated the rules that we had specific, or that the courts had specifically set down for military courts.
Is that the sum total of your concern regarding 914? What about the language that says it should normally be taken by a two-way closed-circuit television system?
Your Honor, that is the second part of my argument, is the military judge, he made a finding that there was adequate fear or there was guilty trauma to this child if they had testified that he was accused. However, when you look at the military rules, Military Rule 11611 doesn't speak to fear of testifying in the presence of the defendant, specifically if Maryland versus Craig, but it just says any fear. So if you look at that rule and then you say, well, the judge found any fear, you're allowing a very slippery slope where any defendant can be confronted by one-way closed-circuit television if a witness can get a sympathetic psychologist to say, well, they're going to be afraid. They're going to have some kind of trauma. So they should not have to even have closed-circuit television. They can be off in another room with one-way television.
Is it your position that, as I asked previous counsel, is it your position that the rules are unconstitutional or as applied here, or is it your position that had they complied with the letter of the rules, you would have been okay?
Your Honor, I feel that Military Rule of Evidence 611 is unconstitutional, whether applied here or applied anywhere. However, as they applied 914, it was unconstitutional in this case. We think they failed to.
Okay, so you're not limiting your argument to a technical non-compliance with the letter of the rule?
No, Your Honor.
So would it be unconstitutional? Wait a minute. Part of Maryland versus
Your Honor, in my opinion, it would be unconstitutional whether it complied with Maryland versus Craig or not. For the simple reason that the dissent in Maryland versus Craig versus Scalia is very close to what the majority actually put in Crawford versus Washington, where they're saying that to give every indicia of reliability, every substantive evidence that this testimony is reliable, you give an oath, you have cross-examination, but you leave out the one procedural guarantee that the Constitution had. The one procedural guarantee it said was you get confrontation. You're doing everything but what it says. It's not constitutional.
Counsel, assuming that we're not going to overrule or attempt to overrule Gray, are you making a constitutional argument in the sense of applying the least restrictive alternative? Is that the essence of your analysis of the one-way versus two-way, that is, if we're going to allow provoked testimony, that it has to be done in a manner that comes as close as possible to complying with the literal face-to-face requirement?
Your Honor, I would make that argument if you were not prepared to overrule Maryland versus Craig's precedent. However, I would like to stress that the precedent in Maryland versus Craig has been significantly undermined by the decision in Crawford versus Washington.
Do you have anything to add to the response of counsel for appellant with respect to what authority this court would have with respect to the precedent that's 17 years old to disregard it and that is directly on point?
Your Honor, the point I would like to make to that question is that military courts have always been at the forefront of protecting a defendant's rights. We had the Miranda, we had Article 31 rights, the equivalent of the Miranda, years before the civilian courts did. On the 413 and 414 rules, when you come out on a 403 balance, we are more weighted in favor of the defendant itself. Military courts do a better job of protecting the defendant's rights, and I think at this juncture, we should continue to lead the way and protect defendants' rights.
Aside from your lead the way argument, are there any federal legal policy arguments? Are there any military reasons why this court should interpret or apply Craig in a manner different than as here before?
Your Honor, if we go back to the original meaning of confrontation and the original intent of the framers, the intent was twofold. It wasn't just that the accused had to look upon their witness, it was so the jury could also observe how the witness and the defendant interacted and make their own judgment based off those interactions of how things happened.
I'm asking a slightly lesser confrontation argument. I'm asking, is there a military reason why we should break from those circuits that had applied Craig as it was applied before Crawford and still apply it that way? Is there some military reason why we should break different? The appellant's counsel said no, but I'm asking if you have a different view.
Your Honor, my view is that to not give the plain meaning to the words in the Constitution weakens that document. And as a military service member, I'm called upon to make sacrifices to defend that document. And to see it argued and ripped apart, it violates everything I believe in and everything many of the majority of the military stand for. We stand for that document to give freedoms and protections to everybody. And to see that not happen is horrible. For lack of a stronger word.
Horrible is fair.
Prior to Crawford, as has been mentioned, the standard was Maryland versus Craig, which did find one-way post-circuit television acceptable. However, that standard had been based on the Ohio versus Roberts decisions, which collapsed the rules of evidence and the rule of confrontation onto the rules of hearsay. And when you look at the precedent set by Crawford versus Washington, the Supreme Court is once again expanding those rules and giving us the full protection of confrontation and not burying them by the whims of public opinion.
Supreme Court that's giving the right of confrontation or the Constitution?
The Constitution is the Supreme Court enforcing it. As has been mentioned, to weaken the Constitution in this way. The framers put it in, put confrontation in specifically, because they wanted to ensure that any prevailing public opinion, any changes, whether we protect a victim here or a different type of victim at a later date, would not affect the defendant's right to a fair trial. And we cannot change that at this point. If there are no further questions, so thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your argument today. Counsel, please argue.
Good afternoon. Hey, police and court. My name is Captain Roger Matthioli. I represent the United States in this case. The holding in Crawford is limited to testimonial hearsay where the defendant is denied an opportunity to cross-examine the witness. So Crawford should not apply to closed-circuit television testimony. That statement by the Kansas Court of Appeals in State v. Blanchett effectively sums up the government's argument in this case. In support of this argument, the government will focus upon three main points. First, MP's testimony was not hearsay. It was testimony at trial subject to full cross-examination. Second, even if this court were to apply a hearsay-type analysis to MP's testimony, it is still admissible because there was cross-examination, which is Crawford's main concern. And third, even if, as appellant suggests, Crawford overruled the judicial reliability test established in Roberts and cited in Craig and this court's decision in the column, closed-circuit television testimony is still constitutional because it is subject to rigorous adversarial testing and preserves every important element of confrontation except the face-to-face requirement.
Counsel, can you address your view as to whether or why we should not read Rule 914A, which says that normally the testimony should be taken versus via, I'm sorry, should normally be taken via two-way closed-circuit television system? That did not happen in this case. Did the military judge make a finding of fact as to why that didn't happen?
He did not make a specific finding of fact as to why that happened, although he did quote the rule, and he did give findings of fact that lead to that conclusion. And again, I would direct this court's attention respectfully to the language of the rule itself, which actually states that the procedure used to take such testimony will be determined by the military judge based upon the exigencies of the situation. So there's broad discretion given to the military judge in that area. And this
subject to the next sentence, though, right?
Yes, Your Honor. However, such testimony shall normally be taken via closed-circuit television system. But at a minimum, it goes on.
Where in the judge's findings does he indicate why this is not a normal situation?
He indicates, again, I would like to refer this court to the fact that that does not pertain to the granted issue in this case, which is whether Crawford has anything to do with the constitutionality of this procedure.
However, why not? If Crawford has something to do with the Sixth Amendment and the policy, the legal policy basis for prior holdings under the Sixth Amendment, why can't we apply that by analogy here to determine how strictly we're going to view the rules that are applicable in courts martial? That is, if Crawford has absolutely nothing to do with the face-to-face requirement and the analysis there, then maybe we'll just apply the rules without any regard to rigor. But if Crawford has something to say about the importance of the confrontation clause, then perhaps that tells us something about how strictly we should look at whether the judge has complied with the rule.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, let's go to the question that was previously asked about the rule. And you quoted, the phrase about exigencies of the circumstance. Where in the military judge's findings does this military judge identify an exigency of the circumstance that would justify using a one-way, non-face-to-face, closed-circuit TV versus the two-way that is described as normal in the rule and that is required, as I understand it, in a trial in federal district court?
Your Honor, if you look at the military judge's finding, he makes very detailed findings as to the harm that will take place if MP is required to testify in the presence of her stepfather.
And where does that judge say, therefore, the two-way requirement of the rule, the baseline normal requirement of the rule, can't be complied with here?
He does not say it specifically anywhere. However, if you look at what he was relying on in making that determination, that is the testimony of Dr. Pacini. There are several places in Dr. Pacini's testimony.
Where does Dr. Pacini address the difference between a one-way and a two-way remote presentation?
At record at page 130, if I can step away from the podium.
Sure.
I'll set you, Your Honor. I direct this court's attention respectfully to page 130 of the record, where Dr. Pacini specifically talks about they're saying that if the accused, she, MP, could not see the accused when she's testifying, it will reduce the trauma for her. And the answer is, it's yeah. Not only my opinion, but I consulted with, and goes on to talk about some other psychiatrists that he consulted with. So there he specifically mentioned the fact that her very substantial harm that you described earlier would be greatly reduced.
That's correct. And did the military judge ever identify or reference that remark?
He did not specifically. He did state that he found the testimony of Dr. Pacini to be compelling and to be credible, but he did not specifically reference that exactly.
And why shouldn't we require that when we're talking about the deprivation of a constitutional right, which, as my understanding, was identified at least since the Maddox case in the 19th century as one of the critical components of confrontation, and that is face-to-face?
Well, that goes back to Maryland v. Craig, Your Honor. And Maryland v. Craig, this is exactly the type of procedure that was contemplated in Maryland v. Craig. That was a case that dealt with one-way closed-circuit television testimony. And it was Craig that led to the implementation of RCM 914A. As this court stated in the column, we have to look at the rule and at the requirements of Craig in determining the constitutionality or the validity of the procedure.
And nothing in the rule for court martial is derived from Article 36 of the UCMJ, which requires the president to apply the rules that are used in the federal district court unless the president determines them to be impractical. On what basis would we find the rules to be impractical? The only thing I found was the discussion, the analysis that basically said, we, the staff people who are drafting this rule, don't like what Congress did in this area, so we're going to recommend something different. How does that address impracticality in the military environment?
It does not, Your Honor. Again, I can only refer to the plain language of the rule, which states that the military judge has great discretion in determining the procedure to be used. It does state normally, but here he found that this was not a normal situation, and he met the remaining requirements that the rule states that at a minimum must
counsel, not the pursue this too much, but where did he say that this is not the normal situation with respect to two-way versus one-way?
Yes, he doesn't specifically state that.
I understand that they've all in this case objected to the victim, given the victim testifying via remote television, correct?
Yes, sir.
Did they additionally object to it being one-way versus two-way or not?
I'm not sure whether that was. I don't remember them objecting on those grounds. However, I couldn't state that with confidence right now, certainly.
Okay, and as I read 914A, it says normally, and I understand that it says normally, but I don't see anything in the rule itself that says that they have to make findings of fact on the record as to why they're not doing it. Is there a case law to that effect?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. And specifically, again, the rule gives great discretion to the military judge. And the lower court here did not find that he abused his discretion. In fact, defenses conceded that it met the requirements of 914A, and they had not appealed on those grounds. Therefore, it would become the law of the case, and absent manifest injustice would have to be accepted by this court. There certainly was no manifest injustice in this case.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
The briefs and some of the case law speak of virtual confrontation, and one of the briefs spoke of essence of confrontation, which sounds like a confusion. But it also suggests you're getting something short of full confrontation, you're getting the essence of it. Is there a delta here between full confrontation and friend confrontation?
The Supreme Court appeared to think that there was, where they stated that they recognized that the face-to-face element is an important element to confrontation. However, as Justice O'Connor goes through in the opinion, she talks about the fact that there can be exceptions, just as there can be exceptions in the case of the warrant.
And this gets to the theory of interpretation. Does the Constitution itself, the Bill of Rights, speak of essence?
I don't know that they do speak of that, but they also don't speak about face-to-face confrontation. And if we go down that road, the court in its language in Craig refers to Coy, which refers back to Supreme Court case California v. Green, also Maddox. And if you look closely at those cases, what they're actually talking about, the Supreme Court quotes Justice Harlan's concurrence, but what the majority opinions in those cases were actually talking about was the right to stand face-to-face before the jury and to have them observe the witness's demeanor. If you look at Maddox, they talk about judging his demeanor on the stand. If you look at California.
Is it the government's view that two-way, understanding this is one way, but is two-way face-to-face in your view? Are you making that argument?
That it is face-to-face confrontation. No, it's not. It's not. It's an exception. Craig, the procedure established in Craig, although that's one way, but one way or two way is an exception to the...
It gives you full confrontation, cross-examination, and no essence of cross-examination, the full cross-examination, but not face-to-face.
That is correct.
Well, in terms of what the Supreme Court has said, we've talked a little bit about what can be derived from the Crawford opinion, and many commentators have pointed out that the... if not the and one of the critical points of analysis in Crawford's opinion was Justice Scalia's analysis of the trial of Sir Walter Raleigh and his confrontation with Cobbett, lack of confrontation with Cobbett, and made these out-of-court statements. The part that Justice Scalia quoted right at the beginning of the analysis said, here's what he quoted from Sir Walter Raleigh's testimony in trial. Let Cobham be here. Let him speak it. Call my accuser before my face. That's what Sir Walter Raleigh wanted. That's what Justice Scalia was talking about in the opinion as one of the foundations of the Sixth Amendment. Call the accuser before my face. Isn't that what he... accused, the appellant in this case, is stating, give me the same right that Sir Walter Raleigh was denied in a case that was critical to the formation of the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation?
No, Your Honor, it's not. And again, if we look at that case, the Crawford decision, when it cited Maddox, stated that the principal evil at which the confrontation clause was directed was the civil law mode of criminal procedure, and particularly its use of ex parte examinations as evidence against the accused. The Sixth Amendment must be interpreted with this focus in mind.
Didn't the Supreme Court clarify just the reverse, that the out-of-court statements are not the essence of the clause, but face-to-face confrontation is?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, it leaves us with the fact that the government is not arguing that face-to-face, the face-to-face element is not an important element of the confrontation clause. It is. What the government is stating is exactly what the Supreme Court said in Craig and all of its progeny, which is that in exceptional circumstances, you can have an exception to that face-to-face requirement as long as, and again, I'm paraphrasing here, but as long as you maintain all of those other important elements of confrontation, which I believe we talked about, the oath, cross-examination, and in this case there was, in answer to a question to the appellate counsel earlier, there was a full cross-examination in this case, and there's no argument about that. It consumes 14 pages of the record of trial, and counsel in this case was extremely qualified in
That's subject to the argument that there may be a fundamental structural flaw.
Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor. Obviously, the government's not conceding that there's a fundamental structural flaw here.
Number 4 for the 541 U.S., I guess 68 to 69, it appears to me at least to be talking about testimony of evidence and saying that what's necessary is that they be unavailable and that there be prior opportunity for cross-examination. That's what the holding of Crawford is. Then the last sentence of the opinion is that where testimonial statements are at issue, the only indicium of reliability sufficient to satisfy constitutional demands is one of the constitutional act actually prescribed confrontation. From that, do you take that what they mean by confrontation is cross-examination?
That could certainly be one interpretation, and I'm not going to try to interpret what the Supreme Court was talking about.
And I think we could all agree it's not a model of therapy to property.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is certainly correct. But again, the important statement, the important takeaway, if you will, from the Crawford decision is exactly what the majority opinion states, which is where you have testimonial hearsay. You must have unavailability and opportunity for cross-examination. And again, turning, if I may, to the government's first point in this case, this is not hearsay. This is not testimonial hearsay. And therefore, it is not subject to the requirements of unavailability and full opportunity for cross-examination.
And as the Supreme Court said on numerous occasions, that the Sixth Amendment is not a rule of evidence, so does it make any difference whether it's hearsay or not?
It does not.
That is, if Congress were to pass a statute and said, we don't want to spend any more money on witness fees, from now on, do everything by remote. Would that raise any issues under the Sixth Amendment?
Of course it would, Your Honor.
Because you wouldn't have face-to-face confrontation.
Well, that's one of the reasons why, absolutely. You also could not show a support for the important public interest. The Supreme Court, in fact, one of the lower courts contemplated that issue. I believe it was in Capitol, but I'm not sure, where they discussed there was some witness testimony taken via closed circuit television from another country. And the court stated that, no, that wasn't an important enough interest to be protected under the Craig analysis.
So at some point, it doesn't matter whether it's hearsay, at some point, face-to-face confrontation then is required by the Sixth Amendment?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. When you don't have that important competing public interest, and there has to be, as Justice O'Connor stated in the opinion, a finding on the record of that.
So why shouldn't we require, in all cases in which there is not face-to-face confrontation, that the government, excuse me, that the court employ the least restrictive alternative, which in this case, under the rule, would be the two-way confrontation?
Again, Your Honor, because this court had the opportunity to make that decision in McConnell and did not make that differentiation. And this is not the time on this granted issue, which is the applicability of Crawford, for this court to expand that finding to where...
Why not? If we're dealing with the applicability of Crawford, which is a constitutional argument, isn't that the most appropriate time to apply a least restrictive alternative analysis?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because again, Crawford is limited, and as I mentioned in my brief, there are several cases by the Supreme Court itself and by the other circuits which have held that Crawford is limited to cases of testimonial hearsay, and we don't have that here. Therefore, there is no reason for this court, in light of Crawford, to expand that test when this court had the same opportunity.
With respect to the Supreme Court said that the analysis of Crawford is not applicable to face-to-face confrontation.
No, they have not stated that.
Can I ask an abstract question about that? When, if at all, would it be appropriate for a subordinate court to disregard an on-point precedent in the Supreme Court?
It would not be appropriate. I don't...
Well, what if the Supreme Court, in the abstract, simply read the text wrong? Is this court always correct, for example?
Yes, Your Honor. The position is yes.
But in the abstract, would you agree that if the Supreme Court applied the First Amendment to a certain seizure case, a lower court should be bound by its oath to the Constitution, and we're not bound by an oath to sorry to tell you. I'm asking a lot of you. You might you concede that?
might I concede that.
Then we should look to the Constitution.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir.
So in the abstract, it could occur. And in our practice, often Supreme Court precedent is not directly on point to military practice, for example, Fourth Amendment cases. So there, you can argue that it's not an on-point precedent, but it is an application of the Constitution to military context. Are there any other cases where we should be bound or guided by the Constitution and rule of case law? It's not a trick question. I'm actually trying to see if I have the menu correct.
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor. My gut instinct is all I could provide, which would be something on the lines of a manifest injustice. But again, I'm not aware of those situations. And they do not apply in this case. There's nothing.
My question was that's why I said abstract. I'm not asking you to defend a complicated question. I'm trying to ask a fair question.
If we were to determine that the Supreme Court has misinterpreted the Constitution to the point it's a manifest injustice, or that a precedent has been eroded, is it our responsibility to rule contrary to the Supreme Court precedent, or is it our responsibility to apply the Supreme Court precedent and then the body of the opinion call the Supreme Court's attention to where we believe that precedent has been eroded? My guess is we probably wouldn't say that we erred, but we might say that the precedent has been eroded and call their attention.
Yes, Your Honor, the second option.
And why wouldn't that be the case here, where the underlying analysis in Craig is based upon the balancing test, and the Supreme Court repeatedly in Crawford said, the confrontation clause means confrontation. We don't engage in balancing of public interest. You don't engage in looking for other forms of reliability. Those things may work in civil courts, but that's not the way we do business here. Why would we apply the same in with respect to Craig, point that out to the Supreme Court, which undoubtedly may be well aware, but they haven't had that case come before them yet. Why wouldn't this be the case?
I actually would disagree with the fact that they had not had the opportunity to have that case.
I didn't say they haven't had the opportunity, I said they haven't had that case before them yet.
Yeah. There have been cases, as I say, cited in my brief, where closed circuit television testimony and its constitutionality have come before federal circuit courts, and they have found that it is constitutional to post Crawford. And
again, as a matter of Supreme Court precedent, does denial of cert constitute anything that we should be equal of here?
No. However, it is something that this court can look to when deciding whether to expand broadly the holding in Crawford, which, again, the government's position is that the court went through great pains to limit Crawford's applicability to where testimonial statements are at issue. Again, if you look to the language of the opinion, it says where non-testimonial statements are at issue, courts are free to apply their own analysis, including the Roberts reliability analysis, which is one of the grounds where the defense is urging that this be overturned because they're claiming that this Roberts reliability test no longer exists. It does. The court recognized that it does. So therefore, this court would, in essence, be going against the holding in Crawford by broadly expanding its interpretation, and that the Supreme Court has not done that itself. As an interesting aside, in Capel, the Sixth Circuit case regarding closed circuit television testimony, the Sixth Circuit found that a child's statements to a psychoanalyst were admissible under Federal Rule of Evidence 8034 statements for the purpose of medical diagnosis and thus non-testimonial. The Supreme Court denied cert on that. And this court has also upheld the medical diagnosis exception in Rodriguez Rivera. Therefore, if this court holds that live closed-circuit television testimony is unconstitutional in light of Crawford, the result would be that a child victim who is prohibited from testifying via closed-circuit television due to her availability and the lack of face-to-face confrontation could then have her statements to her doctor or psychiatrist read before the members under the 8034 exception, and the accused would have no right to cross-examine the child, regardless of her availability. Turning now to the government's third point, even if this court accepts appellant's argument that Crawford rejected the Roberts reliability test, closed circuit Tellersy testimony is still constitutional because it's subject to rigorous adversarial testing and preserves every important element of confrontation except the face-to-face requirement. And in McCollum, this court stated, Craig stands for the proposition that a witness may testify out of an accused presence only where the trial court finds that there's an important public interest that will be served by denying physical confrontation, that such denial is necessary to further that interest, and that other measures will ensure the reliability of that testimony. As I discussed earlier, it is on that third prong where the appellant attacks, but the appellant's argument that reliability is no longer a vital test is flawed in several respects. First, as I stated earlier, the Crawford decision only rejected the Roberts reliability test for out-of-court testimonial statement, hearsay. And that is not what we have here. This is not even necessarily out-of-court hearsay because the Craig court specifically declined to state that closed circuit television was out-of-court. But even if this court finds that Crawford entirely overruled that reliability test, Craig is still good law because of its emphasis on the adversariness of the process, not just the reliability. As the Supreme Court stated in Crawford, the Roberts test allows the jury to hear evidence untested by the adversary process based on a mere judicial determination of reliability. The Craig test does not do so. The jury hears the evidence tested by the adversary process, and they have the opportunity to observe the demeanor of the victim while she's testifying. As the court stated in Craig, the indicia of reliability in the closed circuit procedure comes from the adversary process itself. They stated that although we are mindful of the many subtle effects face-to-face confrontation may have on an adversary criminal proceeding, the presence of these other elements of confrontation, both cross-examination and observation of the witness's demeanor, adequately ensures that the testimony is both reliable and subject to rigorous adversarial testing in a manner functionally equivalent to that afforded live in-person testimony. These safeguards of reliability and adversariness render the use of such a procedure a far cry from the undisputed prohibition of the Confrontation Clause, trial by ex parte affidavit or inquisition. In appellant's case, the military judge found that the three Craig requirements were met. Additionally, here as in Craig, there is no dispute that the child witness testified under oath was subject to full cross-examination and was able to be observed by the judge, jury, and defendant as she testified. MP's testimony passed through the crucible of cross-examination and was subject to rigorous adversarial testing. Thus, the appellant was not deprived of his Sixth Amendment right in front of the witnesses. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. We will now hear from counsel for amicus, presenting argument in support of the government. Why don't we suspend for a moment?
Of the Craig decision in preserving the defendant's Sixth Amendment right at trial against the alternative.
Well, with respect to your first point, didn't the mental health of the trial victim be preserved just as well by just not calling? I mean, I understand that would result in the prosecution not having good evidence, but wouldn't it equally support the mental health of the child victim?
That would deprive the victim of the opportunity to vent what happened to them and to seek justice through the court system. So while it might not have the emotional impact of testifying, it would deprive them of an opportunity to seek justice and to see that parents and adults are interested in setting right when something happens that to them that is wrong. So it would have a psychological impact, but a different one.
But here, the child doesn't seek justice. The state seeks justice. The state is bound by the Constitution.
I believe that victims of crimes do seek justice. They seek to know that the world is right, and they seek, especially...
That's a philosophical proposition, perhaps. But that's not what we're dealing with here.
It's true that the state is responsible for carrying out the criminal process that actually delivers justice. But it is the state's interest to know that the citizens that it governs believe in the system that they live under, and that the system serves them and serves justice and will protect them from criminals, from abusers, from rapists.
You started with your chapeau was that you were going to introduce two public policy arguments, and you might have meant legal policy arguments, but ultimately it's hard to meet you by the law, basically four corners of the issue presented, or is it the search for the best public policy?
We believe that the four corners of the policy are meant to contain public policy interests. And when they do not contain public policy interests, then we have to consider whether or not those are the correct laws and rules to be applying to the criminal procedure. We have arguments in this case that are within the rules, within the four corners of the law and the rules. And they serve particular public policies. Number one, the protection of the human welfare.
So you're basically, one of your objectives then is to point out how your reading of the law is also consistent with public policy.
It's to point out how our reading of the law serves an important goal or objective or responsibility of the government. In this case, the government has a responsibility to protect children, as Justice O'Connor referred to in her opinion.
But you would not agree that our ultimate duty is to apply the Constitution and not concept of public policy in this case?
Yes.
You may have a different goal. I'm asking you to define our role.
I wouldn't venture to define your role, Your Honor, I rise to make the point to the court that this decision doesn't just stand for an isolated rule of law, that this decision has an effect on the criminal procedure system, and that when we have an effect on the criminal procedure system, we affect the ability of...
That we see the law in a broader context.
Yes, that we see the law in a broader
context. But you're not arguing your policy, are you?
No, Your Honor. The important public policy of protecting children is, in fact, referred to within the four corners of the Craig decision, page 852. Justice O'Connor refers to Global Newspaper and FERB as having established a line of cases, a progeny of cases that establish the protection of the child witness as an important public policy, as an important interest of the court. Excuse me. Now, let's talk about exactly what it is that we're protecting the child from. It is true that face-to-face confrontation is, in fact, an other confrontation. And what is that face-to-face confrontation? It's the ability to make a psychological impact on the witness. The defendant's ability to make a psychological impact on the witness to discourage them from making false statements. That is a completely appropriate intimidation when we're talking about adults who we expect to come into court and withstand that kind of scrutiny. But when we're talking about a child abuse victim, then allowing that defendant to have that same psychological impact is basically allowing the defendant to re-victimize the child abuse victim, this time within the context of the court system.
What if the victim isn't an actual victim? What if they're a putative victim that was coached by an evil adult?
That is exactly why we preserve cross-examination. The defendant has the opportunity to reveal that coaching and to reveal the inconsistencies in the witness's statement through cross-examination.
Wouldn't they better be able to do that if they could also look the child in the eye and ask a couple questions?
The defense counsel is able to look the child in the eye, and the trier of fact is able to observe the demeanor of the witness. The only person not able to make a psychological impression on the child is the defendant, and he's deprived of that because of the damaging nature of that psychological impact.
Is it easier to lie to someone when you're about someone when they're there and looking you in the face or if they're not there, and you can't see.
That may be true, but what we're talking about is the cost of that psychological intimidation to a child. And what we allow is the counsel for the defendant to proceed with cross-examination, even if that cross-examination is rigorous, so that the testimony is in fact tested.
So is it a balancing test? Are we balancing the accused's constitutional rights against the potential or actuality of psychological trauma to the child?
It is unfortunate that the child abuse victim becomes the fulcrum upon which the court balances the interests of the defendant and the state.
I didn't ask you if it was unfortunate. I asked you if it was a balancing test.
It is.
Okay.
Given the psychological impact and our desire to avoid having that psychological impact, Craig provides a very good compromise position, the ability to cross-examine the witness's testimony.
In the abstract, if the Constitution, I understand the Constitution, you're ultimately rooted in the Confrontation Clause, and your interpretation of the Confrontation Clause, would you agree that in the abstract, if the Constitution is clear and plain, you don't get the balance? Example, one might make an argument that courts are better suited to exercise the pardon power. The pardon power is squarely placed in the President's hands in Article 2. So in that case, is it appropriate for us or a court to say, well, on balance, it might be better exercised by a panel of citizens looking at all the facts, blah, 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 or do you just look at the plain text?
Justice Scalia himself found that the Confrontation Clause in the plain text itself was not...
No, I'm just asking the abstract question first to see what principle of law you're applying.
No, the plain text is... The Constitution is a living document, and therefore the plain text as it existed is subject to interpretation as it survives through the years.
It's subject to interpretation, but if the text is clear, as applied in context, is it still your view that you move on to balancing public policy factor?
No. If the text is clear, then it would be applied directly. However, even Justice Scalia admitted that the Constitution, or the Confrontation Clause, is not clear. That's why he...
No, I'm just asking an abstract. Okay. And I understand that argument. I'm sorry, I'll let you finish. First, okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do the law part.
The Justice Scalia found the Confrontation Clause being clear. That's why he launched into the history. And that's where he developed the two prongs of the Confrontation Clause, the first being face-to-face, which is the psychological impact that the defendant has on the witness that we discussed and how that's inappropriate in the case of a child abuse victim. And then the second prong was cross-examination, which, as counsel has argued, is clearly preserved. Under oath, the solemn nature of the event is impressed upon the time.
And it's through that door that you get to the balance.
Yes. Now,
does Craig prevent court to consider the same arguments you've made with respect to an adult rape victim? That is, that the adult rape victim was traumatized by the event, will be re-traumatized by the testimony in court, and suffer severe psychological harm and forced to confront the accuser face to face?
It is not our position that it does. That may be a question for another day. Our position is that, as Justice O'Connor stated at 852, in the opinion, children have been protected, and that it is this exception is applied to child abuse victims. This is a very narrow exception. In addition to that, it's important that we consider what happens if we don't have the Craig procedure. What happens without the ability to put the child through cross-examined by closed-circuit television is the prosecutor is put in the position of being forced to pursue forfeiture. Then we have a mini-trial within the larger trial where the prosecutor attempts to prove that it was the defendant's actions that made this witness unavailable. If he can prove that it was the defendant's actions and it was his intent to silence the child by making those actions, which takes nothing more than having a statement that that daddy told me to remain silent.
Please take your time to finish the thought that you're presenting now.
Thank you. If the prosecutor is put in that position, forced to make that argument, what he has to prove at a trial within the trial, by a standard less than beyond a reasonable doubt, is that this witness made this defendant made the witness unavailable. In so doing, he forfeited all the Sixth Amendment rights And the next thing that we have is that the trial within the trial is basically deciding the outcome of the larger trial, because now all of the outside hearsay statements come in without cross-examination if the prosecutor is successful in securing forfeiture. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your argument. Does the defense get it up?
Mind restating that question?
The issue was the MRE and RCN, and in particular the text of RCN that deals with the normal practice of two-way television. And when you originally got up, you indicated that you thought that this case Roser fell completely and entirely based on this court's application of Crawford to Craig. And you now have the opportunity to indicate whether any other issues you wish to bring to our attention, including ones that might arise out of the RCM and MRA.
Well, I think
if any.
There are other issues stemming from the RCM and the MRA. Most importantly, the one on Article 36 of the Nations Code. There is no practical reason to have the two different standards. The federal law, 10 U.S.C. 3509, provides for two-way testimony in the case of consent. MR 611 and 940. There's a purpose for two-way video and 914. And what was done in this situation was one way to get to a conference, and that was the military judge did not put any rationale on the record as to the need for one way to be two-way confrontation, virtual confrontation, as the scenario described.
In the absence of any case law from this court or any direction in the pool that the military judge has to make specific findings with respect to why you would have one way versus two way, how are we going to find that you've used his discretion in not doing so?
That's essentially the problem with the
case law. Is that why you didn't raise it as an issue? I think so. It's a problem with the case, the fact that there is no direction in this court or in the rule that the military judge has to make specific findings as to why it's one way as opposed to the normal two-way. And you said that was a problem with the case, and I asked you, is that why the issue wasn't raised?
There's no holding for the court to review for these discussions.
I don't think you did, but that's okay. But what's my argument?
And lastly, appellant asserts that Maryland v. Craig has been so eroded, the balancing as espoused in Crawford v. Washington is not a proper concern, and the reliability, the foundation on which Craig relies, balancing and reliability from so far eroded must not make this the law. Therefore,
counsel, would you briefly address the government's argument that if Craig is removed from the picture, we are thrown back on trial by affidavit or trial by hearsay, and attempts to drag in all kinds of non-cross-examined statements that would be a part of worse outcome? The government advanced the argument that if Craig were removed from the picture, if closed-circuit television were not allowed, let us assume that for a moment, that the government would be thrown back upon hearsay and attempting to drag in, the amicus spoke about a trial, but did a trial, and I'm really more interested in what the counsel for the military counsel said, that basically would be thrown back on the government's trying to drag in a bunch of hearsay under various hearsay exceptions medical, statements for medical treatment and similar things. And that would be far worse than Craig was doing. Can you address that briefly?
Confrontation demands face-to-face meeting events.
So it wouldn't, is what you're saying, wouldn't happen because it's got to be fixed. Yeah. Okay, thank you. That's fair.
There are no more questions?
Thank you very much, Council. And we thank Council for the parties for their presentation today. We particularly thank Council for meeting us. I hope we support both parties for their presentation. Soon we will recess the court, and after the court is recessed, the judges will stay in place. We will no longer be a federal court at that point, but we'll be available to answer your questions about the military justice system, judging, and whatever else may be on your mind, so long as it's not about this particular case that we have before us. And on that note, the court will recess the court.
Oh, my.